Welcome to Delmarva Radio Theater. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Our drama today is Cantabile, a story that's narrated and told by Annie Molloy, a woman pianist of a certain age who retired from concert performances and now conducts two-week workshops 8 times each year for adult amateur piano students. The focus of Anne's story is her relationship with a brilliant young pianist, Philip, whom even though he is young, she allows into one of her workshops. The play is adopted from a short story, Cantabile, written by John McKeon and published in the Delmarva Review. It was adapted for radio by your host. There are two characters in Cantabile. The first, Anne Colwell, is the storyteller Annie Molloy, and Mike Murphy takes the part of Philip. Anne Colwell is a poet and professor of English at the University of Delaware. Mike Murphy is an emergency services medical doctor in Salisbury, Maryland, and a member of the Community Players of Salisbury. With us today is also the author of Cantabile, John McKeon. John, welcome to Delmarva Radio Theater.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Let me ask you a few questions John. And after we listen to the play, please come back on and we'll talk a bit about it. Is that okay with you?
Sure is.
Schubert, it is said, had fat and awkward hands. Though his music sings, he never learned to play the piano really well. Contrast this with the plaster cast of Chopin's hands, supposedly done immediately after his death. The fingers seem to me implausibly slender and long, but no matter. We impute magic to objects like an artist's hands, just as we weighed and measured Einstein's brain, looking for some simple fact of flesh and structure that would enable us to shrug and say, well, no wonder. We have no similar preoccupation with Beethoven's hands, rather his hair flying, unruly. He had Einstein's hair, or perhaps Einstein had his. Occasionally, someone will remark on my own long, thin fingers, as if they know of my pianism. They will smile and nod in just that knowing way. Of course. How could Liszt or Rachmaninoff hold any terrors for a woman with such big hands? And I did launch my career on just this basis. The flirty ingenue, the merest wisp of a girl, rampaging through the alpha male repertory, all the while showing more skin than might be expected. It worked for a while. I did the global whirligig for a decade until the bookings began to slow. I have read an account that states simply that Annie Molloy disappeared from public view after marrying a surgeon. Some truth there, I suppose. God knows I enjoyed my husband more than the umpteenth night of Prokofiev in Poughkeepsie. Today, I am no wisp of a girl, and if I am flirty, it is in the manner of an elderly lady who thinks she can get away with something. What saved me, and saves me still, is Cantabile. My immense and ramshackle house on the edge of the Choptank River near Cambridge, Maryland. I have no children, and my husband is gone, taken by a heart attack a decade ago. But the house endures, and I along with it. It is, as I say, a big house, 26 rooms in all, and I have filled it with pianos, a showcase grand in the main parlor, and other uprights and grands tucked in everywhere. Eight times a year, I also fill the house with amateur pianists from all over the country, some of them coming year after year to spend 2 weeks living and breathing piano. I've recruited a staff of skilled and patient teachers. I teach myself and love it. We have an excellent cook, and my campers bring their own booze. I don't take anyone under 21. Philip was the exception. From the day his uncle's Volvo dropped him at my door fully 30 years ago. A glorious day of early fall, the herons at the river's edge holding their poses, the grass bright and the river like blue ice. Philip was 16, and I welcomed him because the chairman of the music department at New York University, an acquaintance who had once wanted to be my lover, said he had never heard anyone like Philip, and 2 weeks with me would be just the thing. He had the ideal pianist's hands. You see, I noticed it from the kitchen window. It was arrival day, and the house was loud with laughter and greeting. Philip dropped his duffel bag on the gravel and clutched to his chest a thick canvas case in which, I guessed, he had brought along every scrap of sheet music he owned. He clutched the case like the floatable cushion from an airplane seat, hoping it would keep him alive, but somehow doubting it. His fingers curled around the bottom of the case, the knuckles visible from a distance, the flesh very white. I forced myself to stop spying and hurry outside to greet him. As I had feared, Philip never fit in. He was decades younger than the others and sipped Dr. Pepper during happy hour while the others whittled down their wine stocks. The older women embarrassed him with their attention while the men ignored or visibly resented him. He couldn't tell a joke, didn't follow sports, and couldn't answer a question with more than a syllable or two. What he could do was play the piano. That first morning, I found myself drawn upstairs by an unfamiliar sound, scales. When I say our campers all love the piano and want earnestly to play better, I do not mean to imply any enthusiasm for such tedium as scale practice. Yet there it was. In every key, major and minor, not just the easy keys with the standard fingerings, but the variants and oddities as well, 4 octaves up and down, slowly and quickly, in 4-4 time, 3-4 triplets, in parallel and contrary motion, even with the left hand offset by a half bar. And all played with perfect evenness and fluidity. I noted the room from which this marvel was emerging and checked the day's schedule. Philip. At our first lesson, Philip told me he had been working on the Chopin etudes. Not unusual. Nearly every reasonably proficient amateur wants to tackle an etude or two to measure himself. Which etudes, Philip? I asked him now. He sat at the piano in my studio with his legs crossed. Mine is the finest instrument in the house, and Philip had taken it in with his first glance on entering and now sat running his fingertips along the keys.
Well, all of them, really.
Over the next hour, I discovered that he could indeed play all 27 etudes well and from memory. In such a case, the teacher becomes more of a coach. There was nothing I could teach Philip, no technique he lacked, no errors to correct. So I tried to coach him on interpretive choices, to encourage him to listen to himself more closely, to show him the little energy-saving tricks that could help a performer get through such large swaths of difficult music without cramping or breaking down. What are your plans, Philip? Juilliard? Curtis?
Well, I'll be starting at Johns Hopkins in September.
So it'll be Peabody, then. I know a number of the faculty there. You'll do well.
Oh, no, not the conservatory. Engineering.
Engineering? Have you not considered a career in music?
I don't want to be a professional musician.
But with your gift, you'd be a... I almost said a natural, but stopped myself, because I don't believe such a thing exists, and because I know very well how much labor had gone into creating what I had just heard. You could be extraordinary.
Look, I just don't want to... I won't be anyone's performing seal, okay?
Okay, sure, Philip. He was looking down and scratching the back of his hand. I suspected I had stepped into a long-running argument, and while Philip seemed uncomfortable telling me to mind my own business, that was just what he had done, and would do so again if pressed. Philip stayed the 2 weeks, filled his practice shifts, warmed up only slightly in social settings, and as his contribution to our informal concluding concert, played something relatively easy. I was sure I would never see him again. But the final day, after the last car had pulled out of the drive, as I walked through the hallway of the again silent house, I took from the table the advanced sign-up sheet for the following year, and there was Philip's name, halfway down. He would be back. I chuckled, shook my head, and thought about practicing more myself. He did come back the next year and the next. I tried to guide him into the new repertory and paired him with a couple of other accomplished campers for some duet work. When the fourth year began looming and he had not signed up, I dropped him a note to say if he hadn't decided yet, I could still hold a spot for him for several more weeks. He wrote in reply to thank me and to say that he had enlisted in the Marine Corps. A legend about Glenn Gould, one of the many, came to my mind, the way he walked away from his public career at its peak. He was world famous, in enormous demand. One night, he was pacing backstage when a stagehand asked for an autograph. He signed the program, dated it, and wrote, "My last concert," under the date. I have built myself a similar legend. How I played an afternoon recital in San Diego, hall half empty, mind elsewhere. Afterward, a dozen or so autographs, the usual smiles, all dinner invitations declined in favor of room service, and the next morning someone named Richard Salazar said in the newspaper that my Liszt sonata had been the longest 30 minutes in many a year. I tried to work up a robust hate for this man I did not know, but couldn't. He was right. Besides, plenty of seats had gone unsold before anyone knew what a snore my recital would be. Time for honesty, I thought, on the return flight. I had met Charles and wanted no more Sundays anywhere but home. I had another half dozen commitments to fulfill, but I let my managers know that that would be it for a while. I don't recall any disappointed groans. Charles was then finishing a clinical fellowship at Johns Hopkins Medical School. He owned a beautiful row house in Baltimore, and that's where we lived when we first married. I moved my small grand piano from my old apartment. I gave lessons to kids who didn't want them, plus the occasional adult who lived for them. I found I loved my sessions with the grown-ups, and little by little weeded the kids out of my garden. Then I read about an adult piano camp in Vermont and thought, I could make a go of that here. I had always lived frugally, and my savings were more than ample to buy cantabile when I stumbled on it, and to gather up a bunch of old but sound pianos. Charles toured the house once, declared that the plumbing and electric bills alone would break the bank, and let me know that he would never want to live there. Okay, I said. I don't mean to live here either, except during camps. I painted the house myself. I sanded and refinished the floors. I hung my old concert posters, programs, photos, and framed reviews all over the halls. By way of cementing my commitment, I took one last big bite out of my savings and bought a big new grand piano. And one day, while waiting endlessly for a delivery of new kitchen appliances, I dragged out my thick book of the Beethoven Sonatas, Volume 1, opened to the Sonata Number 1 in F minor, and started again to learn. The day years later, when I got Philip's note about joining the Marines, I went to my studio and found Volume 3 of the Sonatas, creased, stained, and dog-eared, on the floor next to the piano. I opened it to the last of the 32, in C minor, and turned to the final movement. And when I was finished, I sat on the bench and cried, thinking of Philip in fatigues, thinking of his beautiful hands adjusting the telescopic sight of a sniper's rifle, thinking I would never see him again or hear him play, thinking this was a great pity. A great pity. Then one day, About 4 years after Philip's note, his name turned up in a monthly report from my CPA. He had paid a deposit to return to Cantabile that fall. Students for that camp began arriving about 2 hours after Charles departed. My husband, the distinguished and now wealthy surgeon, had taken the better part of one of his valuable days to drive out from Baltimore because he felt he needed to tell me face to face that our marriage was, from his perspective, less than optimal. That he felt he owed himself the opportunity of a fresh start with someone who would be more, what was his word? Committed, yes, committed to him and only him. Charles also felt that he was still relatively young and that, statistically speaking, his field of choices was encouragingly large. He would be quite generous in terms of a settlement, anything I wanted, really, and since I clearly did not want the same stylish urban life that he did, this was really for the best. I suspected he had already winnowed his encouragingly large field of choices to one, a distinctly stylish and urban young yoga instructor with the right body and the right hair to be just the right ornament for his Mercedes convertible. But as he stood in the foyer making his oh-so-persuasive case, I found I didn't care much. Just wanted him gone before the campers arrived. The Philip, who was dropped off at my door that August, was bigger than the boy I had last seen, and he had let his hair grow. He lugged a duffel bag of clothing and a slim portfolio case of music, and he walked with a slight limp. When I came to hug him, he pivoted toward me oddly, and it was only a minute later, as he made his way up the hall stairs, that I realized his right leg was prosthetic. I had heard about the embassy bombing, of course, but I had not seen Philip's name in the newspapers. 3 of his fellow Marines had been killed and 12 injured, and committees in both houses of Congress wanted to know why this and why that and why some other thing. It was a dangerous place, was all Philip would say the first evening in our welcome reception. A hot night, faint breeze through the big screened porch where we gathered. Philip had come downstairs in shorts, and his artificial leg was the unmentioned center of attention. He knew quite a few of his fellow campers and seemed at ease, though he still preferred Dr. Pepper to wine. The conversation danced around more or less gracefully, until finally a fellow camper asked, "So, do you pedal with your left leg now?" Philip laughed, and then the subject vanished in laughter, drink, and music chat. I realized also that I had blindly made a wise choice by rooming Philip with Bradley, a veteran of the first Gulf War, Operation Desert Storm. Bradley, never just Brad, walked with a slight limp and had, he said, a picturesque web of scars on his lower back as the result of an encounter with an amateur bomb in Kuwait. I saw him now, gazing benignly at Philip, and then his eyes shifted to meet mine, and I thought he nodded. Ever so slightly. And I saw them in conversation around dusk the next day, sitting on the low concrete wall that reinforced the riverbank. I noticed a tiny red glow pass between them and smiled, sniffing the air. Big old house makes noise, and if you sleep alone in such a house, you come to terms with the noises. The porch screens hum in the breeze, and each time the refrigerator cycles on, the picture frames vibrate in the stairwell behind the kitchen. That night, or rather, in the quietest hours of the morning, I found myself lying awake, thinking intermittently about my defunct marriage and empty future, staring up into the darkness and listening for a tiny sound that was not part of the usual. Once, when I had first moved into the house, a swarm of bees had somehow taken over the living room, and they had made just such a faint clamor by banging against the bay window in their effort to get out. But this was different, far too rhythmic, and it stopped altogether from time to time. I got out of bed and passed barefoot and stealthy through through the short corridor linking my suite to the rest of the house. Dim light rose through the stairwell, and I moved slowly halfway down the stairs. The noise came from the keys of the digital piano on the landing below, left there for silent practice during quiet hours. I had never realized the keys made any sound at all. Even now, only a few feet away, I had to listen acutely. More audible were Philip's grunts, snorts, and occasional whispers as he stopped, clenched and unclenched his fists, and jumped back into whatever he was so furiously practicing. His leg lay on the floor beside the bench. He was practicing without pedal, working on accuracy and speed, and he was becoming increasingly frustrated. At any moment he might quit and turn around, and not wanting to be caught spying, I crept back to my bed. So it went for 4 days. In truth, I was frightened by the energy I sensed in Philip's silent practice, by the way he lunged through every setback and seemed to want to tear gashes in the music and leave it panting. I crept to the stairwell each of the three straight nights, lingering where I could retreat should he turn abruptly, watching his hands, those white, big-knuckled hands that had fascinated me on my first sight of him, flying sometimes a foot above the keyboard and sometimes sinking deeply into the keys to draw out a love song. I had first risen from bed because I could not sleep. Now I could not sleep because I wanted every night to sit here and listen to Philip's stunning, exhausting silence. And when not enthralled by his hands, I gazed at the stump of his leg, his prosthesis on the floor. The stump projected 8 inches from his gym shorts, the crisscrossing surgical scars not yet faded. It embarrassed me. It seemed a shockingly intimate thing, the nudest thing I had ever seen. Yet I could not turn away. I sought him out one afternoon as he sat on the porch and gazed across the river. "Philip, forgive me for prying, but what are you practicing at night?"
"Oh, did I disturb you? I was using the earphones."
"Oh, no, no. I'm sure you aren't bothering anyone. I simply stumbled on you the other night when I had gotten up for some other reason entirely. Point is, you were going at it hammer and tongs."
"Hammer and tongs. It's Liszt, the Don Juan fantasy."
"Wow, I can't even play that."
"I doubt you'd want to. It's junk, you know."
"Then why do you want to play it?" He leaned forward to rest his elbows on his knees, falling into a series of small nods.
"I've been meaning to ask your advice on something. I've been invited to play at the White House on Veterans Day."
"Philip, that's wonderful."
"Is it? Or is it just a PR stunt? The Marine Band is pulling together a whole bunch of us wounded warriors, a bunch of guys who left pieces and parts in various shithole corners of the world, but somehow managed to live rich and rewarding lives through music. It's supposed to be inspirational, right?"
"Sounds to me like you doubt it."
My first impulse was to tell them to go screw themselves.
"Philip!"
Then I thought, maybe if I do really well, somebody will hear me and want to hire me for other stuff. Even accompanist gigs, piano bars, anything would be better than just sitting around my mom's house.
"It could happen, though I'd hate to think of you doing requests for a room full of drunks."
"I've done it before. It ain't that bad, but..."
"But?"
"But."
"Did you talk to Bradley about it? What does he say?"
"Bradley is strongly in favor of the go screw yourself option. In fact, he says I should accept, perform, knock them on their asses, and then tell the president to his face to go screw himself."
"And you? What do you think?"
"When I first came back, I was in the hospital in Bethesda. And on Memorial Day, they loaded us into buses and brought us down to the mall for the concert. Got us nice seats, front row, so we'd all be on TV. There was some C-list actor who got famous playing a disabled vet, plus a bunch of Hollywood bimbos emoting how much they appreciated us, what heroes we were. All the while I'm thinking, if I approached you in a bar, your bodyguards would beat me bloody. And then they loaded us back on the bus and brought us home. Hooray for the vets. Now go away."
"You said you wanted my advice. I haven't heard a question yet."
"Okay. Should I do it?"
"Play at the White House, of course. Insult the president? No."
"That simple, is it?"
"To me. I'd also consider something shorter and less aggressive than the list. It's a social occasion, after all.
Well, I guess I'll think about it.
Or if you really must bring down the house, work with me on it. I would never program it myself. I meant it when I said I couldn't play it, but I studied it with Alfred Brendel back in the day, and I know it. I know where the snakes are. Stay here for the next 6 weeks. You'll have your room to yourself, all the privacy you want, and you can practice on the Steinway in the living room. We'll work on it together every day. Put a fine edge on the piece before you ride it into battle.
Well, thanks for the offer, but I can't afford you.
No charge. Throw a little something into the grocery fund from time to time is all. I stood to leave, and at the door to the house, I turned back. You're not a performing seal, Philip. Seals do things for scraps of raw fish. I don't know what payoff you're after. That fall, as Philip practiced in the living room, I began work in my study. I would assemble a recital program, I thought, then call in whatever IOUs I might still have to see if I could stage a comeback. A small venue in D.C. or Baltimore would be best, affordable but still credible as a professional stage. Instead of my old pyrotechnic workhorses, I would play a thoughtful program, suitable for a mature artist, and we'd see what happened. What happened came quickly. On our fourth day of work, I put my hand onto the Steinway keyboard to illustrate a fingering, and all at once Philip's hand was on top of mine, softly enclosing, and he turned toward me on the bench. Philip, we have work to do.
Yes. Yes, we do.
Not that kind of work. He let his hand linger a moment, looked into my eyes, and squeezed. He did not mean to alarm me, I don't think, but the strength in his hands made me imagine bones crunching. Philip, please. I'm old enough to be your mother.
And I'm missing a leg, aren't I? Or hadn't you noticed?
Please let go of my hand.
I know I'm damaged, but isn't everyone damaged somehow?
He took my other hand, though I tried to squirm away. Philip, let go of my hands.
I'm sorry.
Don't be. I'm flattered, really. But we'd never be good for each other.
We'd be great together, and you know it.
I don't know it, Philip. I don't know it. And if this happens again, you'll have to leave. We went back to work. Philip didn't try again. He certainly could have forced me, I realized that. We were alone, and he was incredibly strong. Was I attracted to him? Of course I was. He was beautiful. Those hands. But I thought his ardor for me reflected deprivation and proximity more than anything else. He could have better than me, but I would do in a pinch. I was much older than he, and gravity had had its way with my body. Yet, I was sure I could please him. I wanted to, and I knew how. And after all, my Charles had gotten himself a new toy. Why shouldn't I? Then I thought, I won't do it precisely because Charles has. None of this kept the thought from my mind, often at the most unlikely moments. Finally, I made a pact with myself. Later, after the concert, after his triumph, our triumph, we would return to Cantabile that night, no matter how late, and we'd come back into the dark, welcoming house. And if you were still interested then, I would make love to him. All he wanted. And almost enough. Sometimes in your life, you have to wait for the punchline. In Charles's case, he lived the life he wanted for another 6 years after he left me, with his box at the opera and his club seats at the football games, and he and his magnificent Celine blasting their megawatt smiles at the photographers at the cancer ball. He eventually deceased himself, as they say, while in the act. I smirched to think of God tapping him on the shoulder right in the middle of that most pleasurable moments. His quietus smacked him in the chest, and he let out a gasp and a gush, and then his lifeless face landed perfectly between Celine's spectacular breasts. And she thought he was merely spent, and went on stroking his hair for several moments until his unresponsiveness annoyed her, and she poked him in the ribs. Surprise, Celine. I didn't know any of that when I made my pact. But I knew the long-term future was a sucker bet. And I started the next day, content with my decision. As Veterans Day approached, Philip put me on his guest list for the White House concert and left off practicing 3 days beforehand. Enough, he said. He was ready. The concert would be recorded the afternoon before the holiday and broadcast the next night. Of the event itself, I have minimal impressions. I was seated well to the back of the East Room and the acoustics were awful. The president spoke without a microphone. A cellist played and a blues guitarist and a young woman who did a good job on a tough aria. And then it was Philip's turn. And he brought his volcanic piece off without a hitch. So much so that the East Room, a well of polite applause if ever one existed, erupted in a standing ovation that went on for 3 minutes. Then the president stepped forward and held out his hand, and Philip put his hands behind his back. He said something I couldn't hear. The president's smile never faltered, but his eyes darted, and in a moment, Philip had been whisked away. In the post-concert crush, I made my way to his side. What happened, Philip? You just stood there.
Just what I intended from the beginning. Let's get out of here.
No. Philip, you go. I'll stay overnight in D.C. You take tomorrow to clear your things out of the house.
You're throwing me out?
Music isn't meant for spite, Philip. You can't do what you did and be with me. At that, he pulled himself up straight and gave me an overstated, sarcastic salute, then walked away. He was entirely excised from the broadcast, the 20-minute gap made up with filler. It was as though he had never played, had never been there at all. Was I wrong to think music could heal Philip? To think something as prosaic as playing the piano could untie so many knots? It was a faith of sorts. We hear the ecstasy in Beethoven's late music and forget the wretched man. He wrote of kisses for all the world, but his own last gesture in life was a raised fist. My faith had not even saved me, really. I was alone in the quietly echoing house on the river. The sun was going down. The birds skimming across the water, diving to bring sudden death to tiny fish deceived to the surface by the dwindling light. So it went, I thought. We watch our weight, eat our veggies, and get cancer anyway. We volunteer in soup kitchens and shelters only to be hit by a bus on our way home. We pull ourselves up, shake our fists at heaven, and still die. I was so exhausted that night that I considered sleeping in my reading chair. But in the end, I got up and went to the piano and played through the night to the dawn, ending by playing Bach chorales and singing at the top of my lungs in my lousy German. And then the sun was up and the day had begun, and Philip was gone, and the fish in the river were doomed. Well, I thought, there we are. Music doesn't cure, doesn't save nor redeem. But it's the only thing I know that doesn't make everything worse.
John, Philip, our young man, as we've heard, is a damaged young man. He's lost a leg in the war, and in the scene where John puts his hand on top of Anne's hand, kind of a shift in the drama here. He mentions that that he is damaged. And then he comments, but then isn't everyone damaged? Let me ask you, how is Anne damaged in your story?
Well, I don't know if damaged may be a strong word for it, but Anne certainly has built herself a sort of a fortress of solitude on the water. Big old house. Most of the time, she's the only one in it. The nature of her business venture assures that the house will always either be empty or will be full of strangers. She has made some life decisions, probably, that she may feel didn't work out quite for the best. She had a fast start on a big career as a touring virtuoso, but she feels that maybe she squandered that by playing, unworthy sorts of programs, bombastic popular pieces, and playing the same things over and over, year in and year out, never learning anything new, and becoming terribly overexposed. And then at one point she got a proposal of marriage and decided to accept it and realized that she thought she'd be happier with her husband than she was with her piano playing. Of course, in the long run, the husband also turned out to be a bit of a disappointment.
Well, he was a little damaged himself, wasn't he?
Well, he had his own problems, but that's a different story. But, she's feeling at some point that maybe she just missed the brass ring in terms of her music, that she didn't work hard enough, didn't do the right things. But she's getting a lot of satisfaction out of running her camp. She mentions at one point that, she used to give piano lessons to a bunch of kids who resented it and hated it. And every now and then she had an adult student who just loved it and lived for the piano lessons. So she's decided to focus on that and to try to provide a happy, rewarding experience for people who really love the music. And at some point during the story, she also begins to think about making a comeback, probably prompted by encountering Philip with his remarkable level of talent and ability. Is this a realistic thing for her to look at, in making a comeback at this point in her life? Probably not. It's a long, hard road for anyone who wants to be a full-time concert artist. But to have been on top and then dropped out of sight for X number of years and then to try to come back, I think that would be an awfully daunting thing to take on. On the other hand, maybe the process itself might fulfill her. Simply getting back in harness and learning things and working at it, that might make her happy, just to be doing that.
Well, John, we know that that Philip is damaged because a bit is made of his prosthesis and a bit is made by Anne of the sheer nakedness of the stump of his leg, as we heard. So talk a bit about Philip. How is Philip damaged? We know he's damaged physically. How is Philip damaged mentally?
Well, the thing is, there's so much that we don't know about him. All we really see or know of Philip is what Annie experiences firsthand. And think of all of the questions about Philip. To begin with, how did he get so good at the piano in the first place? He's obviously been working hard at it since he was very young. That's an unusual thing for a small boy. When Annie is talking to him about his future, and on the assumption that he's going to a conservatory to pursue his music, and he says, no, he's going to go into engineering, and she's very disappointed by that. And then even more so disappointed to find out that he's enlisted in the Marines. Why would he do those things? We don't know. We only see what Annie sees, and that is that he's defensive about his piano playing. He doesn't want to be seen as a performing seal. He doesn't want to be exploited. He's angry. He's resentful. And for whatever other reasons, the music is not working for him as a consolation. Annie finds refuge and consolation in her music, but Philip, it doesn't seem that he can.
John, what is bitterness? And in what way do you think that that Philip, and then Anne, how are they bitter? I mean, they seem both seem to have everything. Anne has this wonderful place, Cantabile, and a wonderful opportunity to teach and share her music. Philip is damaged physically, but nonetheless, he's a young man. He's got obviously an engineering talent. Plus, he's got this incredible musical talent. How is he bitter, and how is Anne bitter?
Well, you know, when Philip first shows up at the camp, he is not yet physically damaged. He's a teenager still, and she's stretched her rules a little bit simply to admit him, because normally she doesn't take younger people for a variety of reasons. She very well may see him as her second chance. I mean, here is this extraordinary young artist with all of this talent and with this incredible bright future. It's the same position that she must have been in at some point in her past life. And maybe she transfers some of her unrealized ambitions onto him. And when he decides he wants to go and study engineering, she somehow feels that that's just such a letdown. It's and then the later things that come along, the Marine Corps and the injury and everything else, you know, those things pile on to the original. But I even in writing the story, I kept asking myself why Philip would even come to this camp in the first place, other than simply as recreation. And if he was taking it as simply recreation, again, that would be a different attitude than what Annie would have hoped for and encouraged.
Well, he would come to the camp looking for something, wasn't he? And we can kind of guess at the beginning that he comes to the camp in order to improve his work on the piano and his skill. Why does he come back afterward? What is he looking for?
Well, he originally was recommended to Annie by a colleague of hers at a school, and that colleague obviously also would have felt that Philip had tremendous potential as a solo performer. I think, honestly, he's still got an open mind at that point. He loves the music. He knows he's good at it. And he wants to see where it might lead. He may very simply be still adhering to a more conventional career choice in talking about engineering. I think he's still an open book at that stage in the story. An awful lot hasn't happened to him yet.
And when he comes back?
I'm sorry?
And when he comes back? After being in the Marines.
Well, I think at that point he comes back because he's hatched this plan, having to do with the performance at the White House, and he wants to get off into the isolation and the concentrated environment of the camp, so that he can really buckle down and learn this big aggressive, ambitious piece that he intends to perform.
John, I think I sense the same in Philip, but I'm interested in Anne's bitterness. Bitterness is often engendered by loss. What has Anne lost here?
Well, I mean, she has lost her husband.
Except that she told us she really didn't care very much. She wanted him out of there before the campers came.
Yeah, she made a show of not caring too much. But after all, it was the husband that she gave up her career for. And she misses the career probably more than anything else. I'm not sure that she's all that bitter at the end. She's disappointed. When Philip first shows up, she's probably never encountered a young student quite so skilled and talented.
Well, the end,
and she gets
the
maybe
ending,
a little carried away.
The ending, John, has its own twist, and we're going to get into that in a moment. But I am particularly intrigued by Anne, because I think leading up to the end, she does show, for me anyway, a large degree of bitterness. But I did want to ask you about one other thing, and that is that intrigued me, and that is the silent piano. And in fact, the pounding on the silent piano. What is Philip doing here?
Well, you know, these digital pianos are a great idea for a communal setting like that, because you can put the headphones on and practice early in the morning and late at night when you wouldn't be disturbing anyone. In order to make the kind of noise that I describe him making, that mechanical clicking and clacking and, you know, to do that on a digital piano, you've really got to pound at it. You got to be working hard. These are quiet instruments.
Well, hammer and tongs, Anne says.
Hammer and tongs, that's right. Now, obviously, he's practicing something that he doesn't want the others to know about. And he's also obsessed with it because he's practicing at times when any normal person is asleep. She is disturbed by it in the middle of the night and comes out to see what's going on. So, it kind of reflects his sort of maniacal focus on getting this piece and sharpening it up as a spear that he intends to use to make this drastic point that he wants to make.
Anne also mentions to Philip that he could ride when he goes to the to perform at the White House, that he could ride this piano into battle. How is this music looked on as an instrument of almost violence?
Well, the particular piece he's practicing to perform is an extraordinary physical piece. It's very, very demanding. It gets extremely loud. It's very fast in some parts. You almost marvel that the instrument can take it. Then the performer is really going at it. But more than that, in a metaphorical sense, this is sort of his white charger. He's going to use this music to defeat his enemies, however you might put it. It is a vehicle for him.
He sees, to some degree, perhaps, you can correct me on this, he sees this opportunity at the White House as almost a bit of revenge against what has happened to him in the war.
I think that's very much in the front of his mind. And I think he regards the president and the politicians who are making this big fuss over the wounded veterans as hypocrites. And he wants to embarrass them. He wants to, you know, stick a finger in their eye and say, look, we don't believe a word of this. This is all just lip service.
Right. My last comment and question, John, is really the last line of the play. Music, and to paraphrase, music at least is the only thing that doesn't make life worse. Is this a cynical play? Is this a cynical drama?
No, I wouldn't say that, because, you know, Annie, even though she's sad, I mean, she actually ends the story singing. As she puts it, singing at the top of her lungs in her lousy German, in her house, which is named for beautiful singing. And, you know, she's happy with that. She has the music. She's willing to sing. And after all, I mean, the sun is only just coming up. She's got another whole new day ahead of her, and she's going to make the best of it.
Well, John, thank you for a wonderful story that has become this radio drama, Cantabile. And I also want to extend a great thanks to our actors, Ann Colwell and Mike Murphy. And a great thanks to all of you for listening to Delmarva Radio Theater. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.